Good morning, everyone. So, I'm especially excited to be up here this morning because after nearly 7 years of me speaking at Portswood Church, we are finally doing a series on my absolute favorite book of the Old Testament. And in case you don't believe me, I'm hoping a slide is going to come up on the screen that will show my credentials. So, as you can see, that's a photo from the hallway in my flat where I proudly display a huge poster of the Bible Project's overview of Ecclesiastes. And for context, I do also have a few photos of friends and family in the same hallway, but they take up less than half the space of this beauty. Now, if all you know about the book of Ecclesiastes is the passage we read just now, you might be thinking, what a weirdo. How can his favorite book of the Old Testament be this depressing, poetic essay that tells us everything is meaningless and we might as well be dead? But if you've been with us the last few weeks, Jez and Lou have helped us see that there's more to Ecclesiastes than meets the eye. That this book is not just doom and gloom, but there is beauty and poetry in it. And if you look closely, it does actually offer solutions to the bleakness it might otherwise seem to revel in. But if you're not yet convinced of that, hopefully I can help you on your journey of discovery this morning and show you that Ecclesiastes is more than it seems. So before we get into this morning's passage, let me just recap. So the book of Ecclesiastes is written by an anonymous author who passes on the words of the teacher, likely either the wise King Solomon or, in my view, someone taking on a Solomon-like persona. Right from the start, we're hit over the head with this phrase, "Everything is meaningless." Now, most of you have heard this a couple of times already, but it bears repeating. God bless the translators of our NIV Bibles. They have an incredibly difficult job translating from several ancient languages, which for the most part they do excellently. But I can't stress this enough. The word translated meaningless doesn't really mean meaningless. The Hebrew word translated is hevel, which literally means vapor or smoke. And if you'll permit me to get a little bit nerdy for a moment, you might have noticed that we've had slightly different spellings and pronunciations of this word over the last few weeks. A couple of weeks ago, on the screen, we had hebel with a B for bravo. That's the anglicized version, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with using that. But I'm going with hevel with a V for victor, which is closer to the original Hebrew, mostly just because it's easier to say. The teacher uses hevel as a metaphor for things that are momentary and fleeting, like smoke that wisps away. He also uses it to explain how things are a paradox or enigma, impossible to fully grasp. Again, like smoke or vapor, should you try and reach out and grab it. To repeat a phrase used multiple times in this book, hevel is like chasing after the wind. So far in our series, the following things have been called hevel: pleasure, accomplishment, wisdom, hard work, wealth. Oh, and everything under the sun. Everything in life is momentary and fleeting. Everything is confusing and hard to grasp. So if everything in life is hevel, vapor, momentary, hard to understand, what's left? Well, how about death? In the second half of chapter 3, the theme is death. So strap in, this is going to be a bumpy ride. Last week, we had at least heard mention of some good things to compare against the bad. We read about laughter, dancing, love, and beauty. But today, we're right back in it, right back in the dreariness with the most dreary subject of all. Now, there are actually two other themes in this passage, which I would also like to cover briefly this morning. But we can't get much drearier than death itself, so let's start with that, then at least we know things can only get better from there. But as is the case throughout Ecclesiastes, the teacher jumps around his themes a fair bit, so that's what we're going to need to do as well. And because of that, I very much recommend having the passage open in front of you so you can follow along. So starting with death, that takes us first to verse 18 of chapter 3. So chapter 3, verse 18. I also said to myself, as for humans, God tests them so they may see that they are like the animals. Surely the fate of human beings is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Humans have no advantage over animals. Everything is meaningless. Again, hevel, not really an absence of meaning, but fleeting and paradoxical. All go to the same place. All come from dust. To dust all return. Who knows if the human spirit rises upward and if the spirit of the animal goes down into the earth? So even if we soften the blow with the truer meaning of hevel, we're still left with a pretty dreary message. Humans are no better than animals. We just die. Who knows what happens next? Which is an interesting message for the Bible, isn't it? The same book that teaches us that if we believe in and follow Jesus, we can have eternal life in him, here the teacher seems to cast doubt over the very idea of an afterlife. Stranger still, because even though people in the Old Testament times weren't yet granted the full revelation of God's eternal kingdom and his people's place in it, the teacher himself does demonstrate some understanding of an afterlife. Last week, we covered the first half of chapter 3, which includes the line, God has set eternity in the human heart. And in our passage today, in verse 17, the teacher talks about bringing people into judgment in a way that seems to line up with our understanding of judgment after death in the end times. So, like a lot of Ecclesiastes, I see this as hyperbolic. It's an exaggeration. This is a man in his lowest moment. It's the same way that you or I, even if we are believers in eternity, might, in our most exasperated moments, say, "Ah, what's the point in anything?" When really we know there's a lot of point in life and eternity with Jesus. It's the same when the teacher says, humans have no advantage over animals in verse 19, when Genesis 1 teaches us that humans rule over animals. And the teacher clearly knows Genesis because he basically quotes it in verse 20, alluding to the moment God tells Adam, "For to dust you are, and to dust you will return." So again, I read this as hyperbole. It's a big exaggeration. The teacher might know that there's a possibility of eternity, but in this moment, he's just focused on the death part. Humans are no better than animals. Whatever we do, we just end up dying like dogs. But just like in chapter 2, after the seeming hopelessness of hevel, we get some sort of positive conclusion. Verse 22. So I saw that there is nothing better for a person than to enjoy their work, because that is their lot. So death is hevel, but we can still enjoy life. Chapter 2 adds the enjoyment of eating and drinking and makes it clear that such pleasures are from the hand of God. We can enjoy the pleasures of life, but they only have meaning if enjoyed in the full knowledge and appreciation that God provided them. Now, often when we look at a passage of the Bible, we have to do a bit of work to apply its original context to our modern day, as with the narrative accounts of Solomon and the other Israelite kings. Most of us don't rule over hundreds of thousands of people, so we have to find ways of relating Solomon's challenges to our own. But this message, that death is hard to understand, so enjoy life, this is pretty universal. Yes, the bigger picture of the biblical story tells us to set our eyes on eternity, But equally, we don't fully understand eternity and the physical death that precedes it. We just can't. So the teacher says, enjoy life. Find enjoyment in the work you do, whether that's studying, paid work, or the work of looking after family or pets or your garden or voluntary work. Think positive. Find the good and joyful parts of your work and focus on those. Death is Hevel, so enjoy life in the knowledge that God has gifted it to you. So that's our first theme. The teacher, in spite of his at least partial understanding of eternity, is depressed about death, but suggests that before we die, we can at least find enjoyment in our work and other pursuits. But here's the thing. We can find enjoyment in our work. That is possible. But the reality is, work is hard, isn't it? It's draining. It's tiring. We don't always find joy in it. And that leads me to the second of our three themes, the toil of hard work. Now, Lou did an excellent job covering this a couple of weeks ago, so I'll try not to repeat things too much this morning. But just to say that in chapter 2, there's this idea of the Hevel of toil that amounts to nothing when someone else inherits its rewards. And here in chapter 4, in verse 4, we get this idea that toil is just the product of envy. This is Hevel. And in verse 8, that endless toil may lead to wealth, but it also robs you of contentment and enjoyment. This too is Hevel. So what does the teacher conclude from this? From verse 9, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. So this is talking about companionship. Companions help ease the burden of our toil. And while this could include romantic companionship, that's definitely not the only meaning. If you fall down while undergoing back-breaking labor, your friend can help you up. If you become overpowered in battle, your friend can defend you both. If you have two friends, you are a strong cord of three strands. And even that line about keeping warm by lying down together. In ancient cultures, before lovely warm duvets and central heating, members of the same household, not just husbands and wives, often slept side by side as a way to conserve heat. In these verses, with all the military imagery, I'm imagining soldiers sleeping next to each other in a cold tent on the eve of battle. The point being, toil and hardship are an unavoidable part of life. But companionship, community, helps share the burden. So again, bringing this to our modern day, most of us aren't collapsing in a battlefield, but most of us in some way undertake work. I mentioned earlier about studying and volunteer work, and we could add like household chores and any other sort of form of unpaid labor. And if you have a physical disability or an impairment, sometimes just getting around can feel like hard work. In all our forms of work, companions can ease the burden. Having an ear to hear, a shoulder to cry on. Even those of us who prefer our own company. Perhaps some of my fellow introverts can relate to this. Being around people can be exhausting. It can feel like work. But as I found out in lockdown, living by myself and barely seeing anyone for months, at least outside a computer screen, we need other people in our lives. In the right moment, having someone to talk to, someone to listen, can mean the difference between collapsing under the weight of our toil and ensuring we have the strength to endure it. And if you're sat there thinking, I don't have anyone in my life like that, may I recommend a wonderful charity called Safe Families, who I'm sure will gladly help you solve that problem. And might I also recommend to everyone to share the burden of your toil with Jesus too. Some of you may be familiar with the worship song, Friend of God, and its refrain, God Almighty, Lord of Glory, you have called me friend. I used to think that was a bit too familiar for God, maybe even borderline blasphemy to call God our friend. He's our creator and our father, but friend? Surely he's too high above us for that. But the New Testament letter of James tells us that because of his faithfulness, Abraham was a friend of God. And in John chapter 15, Jesus says to his disciples, "You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants. Instead, I have called you friends." Now, with both these examples, it's clear we still have to do our part. It's like with our earthly friends. If you haven't called your friend in like 5 years, are you really still friends? You have to maintain those relationships for them to count. Jesus can be that relief from our toil. He can be that shoulder to cry on through prayer, meditation, and worship. But only if we actually try. Only if we do as he asks. Only if we learn about his desires through his word and advocate for those desires by praying that his will be done. But if we do those things, we will have the greatest friend with the greatest power to ease the burden of our toil. Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, Jesus says, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. Okay, so far we've talked about death being the great equalizer, but that the prospect of death should not stop us from enjoying life. And even though we will suffer in our toil, we can ease that burden through friendship and community. For our last point, we need to go back to the first verse of today's passage. So that's chapter 3, verse 16. The teacher is picking up his main line of thought from before the Time for Everything poem. Back in chapter 2, he was talking about how toil is hevel. Now in chapter 3, verse 16, he says, "And I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there." Wickedness is in the place of judgment, the place of justice. So what is the place where judgment happens, where justice is supposed to prevail? Well, it's the courts of the law. While the legal system looked different in Solomon's day to our modern law courts, the principle is the same. The enactment of the law is supposed to bring justice to the oppressed and judgment to the guilty. But the teacher says, in place of supposed judgment and justice, he finds wickedness, injustice. Do we find that to be true today? Do we find cases where judges or jurors undergo bribery, where the innocent are found guilty and the guilty innocent? Where overly lenient sentences lead to reoffending and risk public safety, and overly harsh sentences lead to unemployment, homelessness, and mental health problems? Absolutely. A product of our fallen world, in the place of justice, wickedness. And what happens when wickedness takes the place of justice? As I mentioned, the themes in this passage jump around a bit, so we have to skip to chapter 4 to find out. So starting at verse 1 of chapter 4, what happens when wickedness takes the place of justice? Oppression. The tears of the oppressed go uncomforted. Verse 2, so bad is this state of affairs that the teacher says, it is better to die than to be alive. And verse 3, even better than that, is to have never been born. Now first, it's worth highlighting how the teacher has woven two themes together, We covered death at the beginning. But as with that theme, it'd be a reasonable assumption that the teacher is once again using hyperbole in this talk of wickedness, of injustice. Because if death is better than life, surely the teacher would have ended his life before writing these words. But the point remains, injustice is a horrible evil. To the victims of it, very often those who are already vulnerable or otherwise disadvantaged, death might indeed seem like the only escape. And if the answer to the hevel of death is to enjoy life anyway, how are the oppressed supposed to do that if their lives have been ruined by wickedness? So again, we find ourselves in the pit of the teacher's despair. But hopefully we recognize by now that at the seemingly lowest possible moment, the teacher always offers us some hope. Back to chapter 3 now, verse 17. Wickedness is hevel, but God will bring into judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there will be a time for every activity, a time to judge every deed. Yet another example of the teacher's brilliant weaving of different themes and movements together. Here we have language from earlier chapter 3 that we covered last week. There'll be a time for every activity, a time to judge every deed. In time, in God's perfect timing, there will be judgment. Not the corrupt, twisted sort of judgment that us humans are so good at enacting in this life of hevel, but the perfect, just judgment that only the one true, infallible, infinite God can enact. Right now, there is wickedness in place of justice. Right now, the oppressed go uncomforted. But one day, God will sort it all out. We'll hear this message again in chapter 11 and when we finish the series in chapter 12. We also hear it in Revelation, another poetic, beautiful, yet challenging book of the Bible. One that tells us of times past, times present, and times yet to come, which tells us that one day Jesus will judge humankind. All have sinned. All have fallen short. All will be judged. Those who have not repented of their sins and followed Jesus will be thrown into the lake of fire. But those who have repented, who have committed their lives to Jesus, will join him in the new heaven and the new earth, the new creation where there'll be no wickedness, no toil, no death, no mourning, crying, or pain. The hevel of our earthly lives, the fleeting paradox, will have passed away. And Jesus and his people will be united forever. Amen.